Hello there, everybody. My name is Bea Bonner, and you're listening to Community Voices right here on NPR Illinois. And today, I am talking to Rakesha Fallon, Associate Provost of Strategy, Communications, and Engagement at SIU School of Medicine. Thank you so much for being here.
I'm really happy to be here. Thank you.
Well, I am so excited. You are somebody that's well-known in the community. I only met you through Zoom, like one time during the pandemic, so good to see you in person.
I'm glad to be here with you.
Excellent. Now, starting off, tell us a little bit about yourself and where you're from.
Gosh, well, anytime someone asks me to talk about myself, I kind of start with I'm the oldest of six, right? I'm the oldest of six, actually, that I grew up with in the house. I actually have more brothers and sisters, so technically I'm the oldest of 11,
wow.
But six in the house. Mm-hmm. So all that leadership, I come by very naturally. Grew up in Central Illinois. I'm a Central Illinois girl. I was born in Peoria.
Wow.
My family moved to Lincoln, Illinois when I was 12. And so I spent a lot of years in Little Lincoln, Illinois, hanging out on farms with my friends. And, you know, it was interesting time. But I spent a lot of time in Lincoln and did some time in Chicago when I started my career after graduating from UIS. And then when I got married, came back to Springfield, and Springfield really is home. Now, this is where we got married. This is where we had our babies. This is home.
You know, I try to tell people, I'm still from Chicago, everybody, but the more and more I think about it, I'm like, well, you went to school here forever. You got both of your degrees here. You met your husband here. Now you live here, so I guess you're stuck.
Yeah, you're like, where am I going to be buried?
Yeah.
That's how you answer that question.
I'll keep that in mind for the future. Well, I did want to talk about your time at UIS a little bit. Now, what did you study when you were here?
Yeah, you know, I was always interested in politics. Mm-hmm. I was interested in public policy. I had a lot of interest, to be honest. You know, I didn't know when I grew up if I was going to be, I thought, I'm going to be a lawyer or I'm going to run for office. I thought about being a minister.
Wow.
I thought about being a journalist. And so when I came to UIS, I really wanted to kind of work in this intersection of politics and communications. Communications really is the through line in all of those professions that I thought I wanted to be and what I do now. So I did my undergrad in political studies and as much as I could focused on the public communication side of that. And then I came back and did a master's degree in communications later. And graduate school was really great. I was able to work for Illinois Issues Magazine.
Yeah.
It doesn't exist anymore, but
we marched with them.
Yeah. The Center for State Policy and Leadership was my home during graduate school. Mm-hmm. So I got to work with that team of editors to put together that magazine. It was a really great part of my experience. And so, yeah, I'm really grateful for all the ways that UIS and their programs, especially in political science and communications, really have been launch pads for a lot of people who are interested in public service and think about Springfield as a launch pad for that, being with its, you know, connection to the state capitol.
Right.
And I was one of those. I wanted to be where I could immediately immerse myself in an environment of public policy. And so that's why I chose UIS, and I'm so glad I did.
Well, I kind of have a similar story. Went to school here, then started interning at NPR Illinois. Then I said, all right, I'm going to go back and get my master's. Started working here full time, and now we're here. So I really do think you get the opportunity to be real hands-on here in Springfield.
Yeah.
Well, it worked out for you because you got a career in politics. You were talking about being press secretary. And so I got to read about that a little bit. Now, that job scares me a little bit.
Oh, it you should be comfortable. You would be comfortable. Ooh, you'd be pretty good.
I don't know, Rakesha. It scares me. Tell us about your time as press secretary.
Well, I actually had thought that eventually I'd like to be a press secretary. Mm. Why? Because I watched The West Wing and C.J. Craig was my favorite character. Still is my favorite character. You should go back and rewatch that show.
Yeah.
Lots of it still holds up. The C.J. Craig character still holds up.
We're going to take your word for it.
Yeah. But, you know, I had always thought that that would be a good role for me because, again, my love of public policy, public engagement kind of matched with this communication skill set that I had. I thought that's an ideal role. So, I was able to do that role working for Senate President John Cullerton for just over 7 years. I still think that the first 2 weeks of that job were the hardest professional 2 weeks I've ever had in my life.
Yeah.
Prior to that, I had been working for another state agency overseeing communications for the state agencies. Mm-hmm. And so I would hire and train the agency spokespersons. Yeah. And that was at the time Blagojevich was the governor. And I will never forget the day that the governor was arrested.
Oh, man.
Because my BlackBerry. You remember BlackBerries?
Yes. Oh, my gosh. I wanted one of those so bad. And a razor.
My BlackBerry was going off and I kind of ignored it. And I was getting ready for work. And I thought, let me look at this. Why is it going off? And it was all of the PIOs from the state agencies. And they were reaching out to me and they're like, Rakesha, was the governor arrested? And I said, girl, no. He was not arrested. You know, I went about my business and I'm like, wait a minute, let me check. Well, sure enough.
It did happen.
Now, mind you, I had only been in the administration for about a year.
Wow.
And I had a great job, didn't know a lot of folks in the governor's office, but had a lot of proximity to that office because of my role. And that day, I remember I went to work and I gathered the team of PIOs that were in that office with me. And I was like, here are the facts. Here's what's going on. The governor's office is going to handle all the questions. Now, whatever you need to do today to make you feel comfortable, I want you to do that.
Yeah.
And if you need to put in time off requests, if you need to take a longer break, be appropriate, but do whatever you need to do.
Wow.
And I closed my door when they all left and I got my resume out. And I did what I needed to do. So
I
2 weeks later, I got offered the job to come and be the new press secretary for a brand new Senate President John Cullerton. So I took that job. I was excited to do it. But the reason it was the most difficult 2 weeks, I think, is number one, I had a quick transition from working in the Blagojevich administration.
Right.
Quick transition from working in the Blagojevich administration to working in the Illinois Senate. Mm-hmm. And the reason that was significant is you have to remember that during an impeachment trial, it's the Senate that does the trial.
That's right.
So in 2 weeks, I went from working kind of part of the Blagojevich administration to being the lead spokesperson for the impeachment trial against the governor.
Ooh.
And so it was a sharp turn.
Mm-hmm.
It was very high stakes. There were TV cameras from MSNBC, CNN, wow. Every major news network was there. And it was my job to make sure they had what they need for their stories that day. And so I think about that as a real turning point in my career. But I also really stand by it. Hardest 2 weeks I've ever worked.
Oh, I know it was.
In my life.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Well, how did this shape your approach to crisis communication? Because I can only imagine having to be on both sides there. So how did that shape your approach to crisis communication?
I think for me, a keystone here is, and it's not just crisis communications for me, it's just about all communication, is recognizing that when your audience is uncertain and unclear, the best thing that you can serve them is clarity, which is, by the way, not the same thing as certainty. But if you can at least give them honesty, authenticity, and clarity in the moment, here's what I know right now, right? And I'm gonna constantly update you. I'm gonna make sure that when you're feeling this discomfort of not knowing what's next, I'm gonna be a trusted messenger for you.
Yeah.
That's the ground that I take in crisis communication, is making sure that I am a reliable messenger and that when I can, I offer clarity about where we are, even if I don't have a lot of certainty about where we're going.
Yeah.
It's, can you make sure that people have the clarity they need in the moment?
Yeah. You know, I've dealt with a lot of this year, you know, with the federal funding and everything else going on in the world. And we got that news late at night and we were supposed to have a newsletter go out that morning. So, you know what? I had to take a break. I'm like, let me take a break real quick. Let me think about this. What are we going to do? How are we going to respond? And we ended up recording a Community Voices about it. And we were just honest, like, we don't know what's going to happen next, and we don't have all the answers now, but we're like, we'll find out for you, and we've been trying to keep people updated. So I really relate to that, because it's just like, you want to be clear, you want to sometimes concise, you don't want to put out too much. So that's one thing I am learning as I'm handling more of these situations. But I think on the outside looking in, people don't realize it can be a lot having to deal with those situations when they come up. So how did you deal with that personally and go home at the end of the day and relax and try to get away from it?
Well, I'd be lying if I didn't say that the whole thing was a little bit of a blur at this point. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm literally just getting it done, just trying to return the phone calls, just trying to every single day meeting with the Senate president and his leadership group. And Andy Menar was the chief of staff at that time. And really, what's our message of the day? What's happening today? What's the legal advice today? What can we say? What can't we say? And really, it just, you know, in the moment, you have so much coming at you when you're in crisis.
Yeah.
And any leader who has led an organization or a group through crisis knows this, right? You have so much coming at you in terms of what actually happened. But then you have this need as a leader to make sure that all the people around you feel settled.
Right.
And so you're trying to deal with the crisis. You're trying to figure out the thing. And at the same time, you have to lead.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think that's the tension. And there are times where you can't figure out the thing. And so it's like, OK, I'm going to at least make sure my people are OK.
Right. That's all you can do sometimes.
You know? And there are times where you got to focus on the thing and the people just need to trust you that you're focusing on the thing. But I think it comes down to recognizing when people are in uncertainty, and your job as a leader is when you can provide clarity to help settle some of that.
Yeah. Now, for you, when did you know it was time to leave this whole world of politics?
Well, I can tell you a couple of things that were indicators. After 7 years of working with the Senate President's office and in my off time working on political campaigns, I started to notice that I was pretty worn out about needing to be on the record at all times. And that's a tough gig, right? Being on the record, being on at all times. At the same time, people might remember this from when my time in the Capitol, I'm waddling around the Capitol, nine months pregnant. You know, I had both of my babies at that time. And if you've never worked in the Senate or in the legislature, you know, during session, you're there from, you know, 7 to 8. You know, it started to be out of sync with where I was in my life and with my kids and what my needs were. My husband was also growing an organization. Mm-hmm. And the demands of that particular season of my life, it just didn't match anymore. Mm-hmm. I also had a bit of an entrepreneurial business development bug, and I really wanted to test whether or not I could own my own schedule, work for myself. And taking that risk at that time made a lot of sense because of my ability to be more flexible, to raise my toddlers, to really help my husband as needed as he was building the outlet. So it just simply matched with the season of my life. Do I miss it? This just came up. Not really.
Well, at least you're honest.
I sometimes I'm compelled to help candidates because I, particularly women candidates, I do a lot of training still. So I may not be on the campaign trail, but I'm still doing a lot of training new leaders on how to get their story out, how to deliver their key message. And that training and coaching is really the place that I do want to preserve when it comes to public policy and politics in Illinois. I do want to be a part of helping to groom leaders that are going to be the next generation of leaders in Illinois. I deeply care about this state. I deeply care about this city. And if that's my contribution, that's my contribution, is I want to make sure you feel every time you get to the mic, you've got a clear message, you know who your audience is, and you know how to meet the moment.
Well, let me ask you this then, because you just made me have an aha moment. For this next generation of politicians and leaders, what do you see as the main things they need to bring to the table when it comes to campaigning or meeting with people?
Well, we can talk about it in terms of campaigning, and I think this will fit. But I will also just broaden this. Public leadership of any sort, and that can take any form. You could be leading a church, you could be leading an organization, you can be leading a rally. But anytime you're stepping into the spotlight to take a public leadership role, I think one of the things that I always coach for is know what your vision and your mission is. And that's got to be solid. When I'm thinking about candidates, you would be shocked the number of times I'm talking to candidates and I say, why are you running? And the answer, they don't know.
Yeah.
Or here's what I actually suspect, B. They know, but they're too embarrassed to say.
Ah.
Right?
There we go.
Right? Because they don't like that person and they want to beat them. Mm-hmm. Or because they want this or they want their name. Like, they don't want to say, right? Because sometimes there's a narcissistic kind of approach to these things. But I think knowing why you are there and why this is important, you match the moment. Mm. And what I mean by that is, understand where your community is, understand where your community has come from, and what is your community asking for right now? And really taking stock about whether or not your leadership skills really matches the moment, right? And I think that's something that I would ask any new candidates to think about, right? Because it's no longer just who's the best speech giver, mm-hmm. who's got the most money, where is the community at? Where is the country at? Where are we, what are we struggling with? If it's the price of eggs, or if it's the price of bread, or if it's inflation, or whatever it is, how does your candidacy actually match the moment that people are asking for? And I think when you can come to these public roles with that kind of clarity, mm-hmm. right, of not just knowing you have a good message, but knowing that message matches the moment,
yeah.
is where the real magic is.
We'll be right back to listen to the rest of today's show. You are listening to Community Voices on NPR Illinois, 91.9 UIS. We are back to more Community Voices. I'm co-host and editor Bea Bonner. We will now listen to part two of today's interview with Rakesha Fallon, Associate Provost of Strategy, Communications, and Engagement at SIU School of Medicine. Not only did you start consulting for politicians, but also healthcare. Why the switch?
Yeah, it was actually a little unexpected. I had a few clients in my consulting days that were healthcare focused, so I started to kind of dabble my feet in healthcare, but it really was not an aim or a goal of mine. And so after doing consulting for a number of years, and I'll tell you a little secret, I didn't like it.
Oh my goodness.
I didn't like it. It's one of those things. Here's the lesson though. You can be really good at something and it does not mean you have to do it.
That's true.
Because on paper, it was working. The phone was ringing. I never had a lack of clients. But I'm telling you, hustling up 55 to Chicago and back and all of the work. I'm working 70 hours a week. And I desperately missed being a part of an organization that's bigger than me.
Yeah.
I really wanted to be a part of a missional organization. And I tell you, maybe this is why I was a good press secretary. Because it's easy for me to get behind your mission and promote your mission. But getting out there and selling Rakesha Fallon, like, kill me now. That is absolutely exhausting to me. So I really started to think about, after a few years of consulting, okay, where can I go that would allow me to use my skill set, but for a greater purpose? And the opportunity to go to SIU School of Medicine came to me, and it was a light bulb. And I love being there. I've been there now 7 years. And the transition to healthcare, you know, I had a little bit of a learning curve, not necessarily on communications, but the marketing piece of it. So, you know, if you're doing marketing well, it's not just, you know, it's not press releases and, you know, cute things in Canva, right? If you're doing marketing well, you are a business development specialist. You are a thought partner to build business. And so it gave me the opportunity to do a bit of a switch to business development and strategy. And I have loved it ever since. I've grown a lot in my roles and my responsibilities at SIU School of Medicine. And I take more of a strategy role now than I did before. But, you know, the only thing that, in hindsight, I think I wish that I had considered something that nobody would have considered. And that was that, you know, I started in 2018. And by the time I got my feet under me in 2019, 2020 rolled around.
That's right.
And a whole new thing happened in healthcare, right? Where I thought healthcare might be a safe and easy place to be. All of a sudden, that got disrupted for me and for everyone in the world.
It was the battleground.
In 2020.
Yeah.
And so to be a healthcare communicator focused on engagement in a time where people were disengaged, splintered, socially distanced, was really, really a crucible, I think, for me and my team. But what an opportunity to highlight the value of having a medical school in your community. What an opportunity to talk about the importance of medical education and why it matters to train the next generation of physicians that are going to grow here, be trained here, and stay in Central and Southern Illinois. So I've been really, really grateful for every opportunity. that I've had at SIU, and I hope to be there a while longer.
Yeah. Well, you've been doing a great job in telling the stories there. I mean, I see all the work you all are doing, and it's just amazing because sometimes we don't think about, you know, the doctors as, you know, personable and outward facing. But the more I get them inside the studio to come record and what they're doing, I'm like, we should be telling more of these stories. So yeah. How do you work through storytelling for a place like a hospital or, you know, like a school? Yeah.
Yeah. I think you actually hit the nail on the head. Mm-hmm. All good storytelling is really about human connection.
Yeah.
Right. And so when you can get a doctor in to talk to you, B, mm-hmm. and white coat off, and you're just talking about their human interests and connections, people start to make connections beyond the white coat. Yeah. And I think that's what's important. Actually, the white coat can be almost like a barrier.
Ooh,
people
yeah.
see the white coat, they tense up a little bit, they withdraw a little bit. There's a little bit of kind of a power structure that happens yeah. in the room. But get the white coat off, get them to a place where they can share their stories and they can connect with other people in a really relatable way. I think that has really been the secret sauce, not just for our physicians telling their stories, but also for our patients. But the base of that is human connection.
Yeah.
Let's strip away the titles and let's talk about what unites us.
Yeah. And how do you bring inclusivity into the picture? Because that's something that has been really big over the past few years when we've been talking about being diverse, making sure we connect to all people and not just one group. So how do you do that through your position?
You know, part of it is just making sure that the content we put out into the world, whether it be photos or social media content or our magazine or even who we choose to send out to speak at events, really does reflect the diversity of the community. And so that everyone who encounters SIU gets to sense that they belong there. Black, white, doesn't matter what age, what demographic. And so we do have an intentional approach to making sure that the stories we spotlight, the people and the programs we spotlight reflect the entire community. Do we get pushback from that every once in a while? I think so.
Yeah.
But again, it's about making sure everyone feels welcome. Everyone feels seen, right? Mm-hmm. Not one group over another, but we want to make sure that when someone walks in the door, they see something that lets them know that we are expecting you.
Yeah.
And we're ready for you.
Yeah, because sometimes people like me, I get scared to go to the doctor, mm-hmm. and I'm like, I don't want to go there. But I find that me actually having conversations with these doctors and the nurses and the people that work at the hospital, it puts me at a bit more ease. I said, okay, they're human just like me.
They have,
you know, thoughts and feelings just like me. So I really think the communications piece is important. And I was wondering, do you have a story or a campaign or something that you've worked on for SIU that has really touched you or touched the community?
You know, I think one of the focuses that we have taken in the last couple of years is really focusing on the ways that SIU champions healthcare in a way that no one else can. And that sounds like a lot of vibrato. Mm-hmm. It really does. But what we mean by that with our champion campaign, which has not been explicit, by the way, mm-hmm. you're not seeing billboards that say that necessarily. It's more of a brand positioning. We're really trying to spotlight all the ways that this community benefits from having a medical school,
yeah.
from having a robust residency programs and fellowships that are fueling our hospitals and fueling yeah. our community. And it is that unique opportunity that we have as a community-based medical school that makes us stand out in ways that no one else can. There's only one
yeah.
medical school here.
That's right.
And I think, too, using that champions frame, and by champions, what we mean when we say SIU wants to be a champion for the community, when you think about a champion, we also use the term advocate.
Mm.
We want people in our community to think about SIU as a champion and an advocate for them in their healthcare. What does that mean? If someone's an advocate for you or an ally or a champion, they are moving hard things. They are speaking up for you. They are, better yet, not speaking up for you, but telling everybody else to be quiet so you can speak and be
yeah.
heard, right? And this idea that they're coming alongside of you, right? And that is the goal of our interactions right now, whether it be on our billboards or in what's happening in our on our signage, but even more so the way that we train our customers or our employees on mm-hmm. customer service. You need to make sure the goal of every interaction with SIU is to make sure that every single person feels like you're a champion for them. And that means that they feel seen,
mm-hmm.
they feel heard, and that they feel understood.
Yeah.
Even on the hard days when you can't even solve the problem, when you can't give them a cure, when you can't give them the med they want, or you can't provide the answer that they want, the goal is still that when they walk away from the interaction with you, that person still feels like you heard them, you saw them, you care about a solution for them. And if that happens, even when you can't solve the immediate patient problem, they're still going to feel like they have an advocate. They're still going to feel like someone is a champion for them. So that's the goal. I think we have a long way to go to make sure that our internal experiences match all of that, what we're promising. We have some work to do on that. And that's one of the things I'm focused on, but we're committed to it.
Yeah.
And I am really excited to see how this campaign, this focus on champions, really evolves.
Well, I'm glad to see these two disciplines really come together, this communications, this medical world, because when I was in undergrad, there was like a little thing between, you know, us that were in like the English and the communications classes, and then our pre-med and our nursing students had a thing going on. And I remember taking one class and it was media based, and all my friends that were in the science world, they were failing that class and they were asking me for help. And so I didn't think that quite understood how communication is so important in their field. And same thing with me. Now as an adult, as I'm interviewing people in the medical world, I'm like, oh my gosh, those terms and those phrases and the things my friends that were pre-med were trying to teach me is so important, because now I know what I'm talking about and I'm not sitting here like, well, could you tell me what that term means?
Yeah.
So Rakisha, can you tell us how communication goes into these other disciplines and kind of work hand in hand? Because some people are like, well, it's a medical school. Why do you need a communication strategy? I really want you to hit home on that so people can really understand.
Well, as a communication strategy, I think there's not an industry in the world where you don't need communication strategy, yeah. Right? Because again, it's about human connection, right? So try to sell any brand without connecting yeah. with your audience and thinking about the language, the motivation that really is going to speak to them. But I think one thing is post-pandemic, you're talking about, you know, kind of the divide between, you know, some of the sciences and some of the liberal arts, mm-hmm. you know, in the past and your undergraduate yeah. days. I think one of the things the pandemic taught us is failure to communicate
well
about healthcare, about vaccines. A failure to understand how to navigate misinformation and disinformation. Look, my job, communicators' job, particularly communicators in health, has gotten so much harder since 2020.
Yes.
And so I would say even now more than ever, being able to communicate and navigate the difficult, disruptive political terrain that is healthcare communications yeah. is more important than ever.
Yeah, I really agree with that because, let's face it, there's a lot of misinformation out there. And you need somebody that can cut through that and give you the real information. So I am just so appreciative of the work you're doing. And we get to see that in our community. And I think we're so lucky. But speaking of our community, you and your husband are always so busy doing things. So tell us some of the things you're working on outside of work.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, I'm really proud of the outlet and the organization that my husband has been building for well over 20 years mm-hmm. now. A lot of people don't know it's actually that old, but mm-hmm. he was working actually in Jacksonville, and he kind of started it as a small program in his family church mm-hmm. in Jacksonville and grew it. And kind of there was a point in time when we recognized that, you know what, Springfield is home. This is where we need to be building. This is where yeah. we need to be investing. And so over time, he has grown that program significantly. We have made, you know, all kinds of acquisitions, you know, for property to make sure that we have a safe and comfortable place for our boys and for our community partners. Mm-hmm. And over time, it's just really honestly exceeded all of our expectations. The core of the work is the same. It's still about how do we make sure mm-hmm. that boys that need role models, boys yeah. that need trauma-informed care, boys that need job and career readiness, have that support through our program. But it's still basically one-on-one mentoring and a lot of group mm-hmm. sessions to help get them on that path to manhood. And, you know, Michael is really busy right now. He's not only running the programs and doing all the fundraising, but we have a major renovation going on. We purchased the old St. Joseph's home several yeah. years ago, and we have been really grateful to be able to work with donors throughout the community and state partners to raise money to start a renovation on that project. So we are fully in renovation mode while continuing our programs and looking for ways to continue to meet the needs of the community. And we wouldn't be able to do that work without two very understanding kids. We have a 13-year-old girl and we have a 15-year-old boy, and they are just as much a part of that mission. We really do consider it a family mission as we are. So I feel really grateful. It is our family calling and one of the ways that we invest in this community. But the work really is Michael's.
Yeah, you know, I've seen pictures of some of the work you all are doing, and I think mentorship, especially for young boys, is so vital right now. I feel like everybody needs a good mentor, but especially our young boys, they need someplace safe to go and role models to look up to. So I think that's great. Now, Rakisha, anything else coming up in the next 10 years for you? What are you going to be doing? I feel like you're going to be running for office or doing something crazy by then.
Okay. Well, little secret about me. Uh-oh. I have never been able to answer that question. I am by nature what's happening right now, mm-hmm. what do I need to think about right now, or okay, how do I clean up what I made, the mess I made in the past. Gotcha. I have never been good at answering that question. What are you gonna do in the next 5 years? What are you gonna do in the next 10 years? I'm actually getting better at it, because now I'm in a strategy role. Well, you can't do that without doing some future casting.
That's
right?
True.
And so it's actually stretching me personally to think about, okay, where am I going? How am I gonna get there? I can tell you right now, I'm not running for office.
But you would be so good at it. Okay.
I'll tell you, my sweet spot, you want me behind the scenes.
Okay.
You want me to help you. What you want, B, you want me to help you run for office.
Oh, I don't know Great. About that. Oh, I don't think people would be very happy about that.
No, I really do love coaching and training leaders and politicians, yeah. and really being behind the scenes and getting them where they need to go. That's really the role that I love. I have no interest in running for office.
I tried it, y'all. I tried it.
Yeah.
Well, before we go, anything else you want to add or a note you want to leave us on today?
I just want to say I'm so thankful for this show. And for NPR, you know, as a lifelong listener to NPR, which my kids don't love, we actually just had this conversation in the car the other day because my daughter said something about NPR because it's always on.
Yeah.
When I drop them off at school or when we're driving anywhere. And Mary said something and that was, you know, not the best compliment for NPR, but she's 13.
She's 13. We understand.
I said, one of these days, you're going to be talking to someone and you're going to say something so insightful and curious mm-hmm. and worldly. And they're going to say, how did you get this knowledge? And how did you understand these things? How were you able to put two and two together? And you're going to look at them and say, well, my mom always had NPR mm-hmm. on in the car.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I'm really, really grateful to be here. Thank you for inviting me. Yeah, I love this station, and I know it's a really challenging time for public radio, but you guys have lots of cheerleaders.
Well, thank you so much. And Mary, here's a message for you. Years ago when I was in school, I thought the same thing. I will never need NPR. Our teachers were trying to get us to listen to it. But I will say, years later, it came back to get me. And I interned, and then I went full-time here. So your mom is absolutely right. You never know when you need it.
Right.
So for everybody out there, thank you for listening. And Rakisha, thank you so much for joining me today on Community Voices. To hear more from the Community Voices team, visit nprillinois.org.